So, Matteo and Kien are going to tell you how to unbreak things even if they aren't broken. So their title is If It Ain't Broken, Do Fix It, Building Modern Cryptography. So give a warm round of applause and we will start.
So, hello everybody and welcome to If It Ain't Broken, Do Fix It, a primer on building modern cryptography. Before we start, a few things about me and Kien. We are both PhD students at the Applied Cryptography Group at TTH Zurich, and we spend most of our days analyzing protocols, that is, cryptographic protocols, for fun and not so much for profit, actually, but it is fun. And we actually finished these slides yesterday night, so be patient if there are some typos or some unclear things. And thanks to Krusler for the night pick. Okay, so to start, as academic cryptographers, we are constantly faced with the question, or with the sentence, it ain't broken, right? Like, my cryptography has been withstanding attacks for years. There is no practical attack against our construction. And what I want to tell you is that cryptography, much unlike Roman aqueducts, is not something that is built to withstand millennia. And if something starts to break, then we should take radical action to repair it, or to tear it all down and build it anew. This is Ponte Morandi in Genoa. To start, like, to motivate this position, I will start with the SSL TLS saga. So many of you probably know about SSL, or TLS is the green padlock protocol that protects all of our internet connections. And everything started with nothing. There was no cryptography at all. Then in 1994, SSL v2 was released. And this had many attacks and has widely been regarded as a bad attempt, we may say. So just 1 year later, SSL v3 was released. And SSL v3 was subject to every possible attack you can find in an applied cryptography handbook. So we have padding oracles, we have repeated IVs, we have Blickenbacher's attack on RSA constructions. So no surprise, other versions were released, like there was TLS version 1.0 in 1999. This created a lot of confusion in the naming of SSL. It's still the same thing, secure socket layer and transport level security, but the name changed, and you will piss cryptographer off if you call it SSL nowadays. The name changed more than 20 years ago. So let's call it TLS from now on. And we keep having bugs and different implementation and cryptography vulnerabilities. In 2008, TLS 1.2 gets released. And that's a bit of a landmark. TLS 1.2 will last from 2008 for 10 years until TLS 1.3 is introduced in 2018. And even if this TLS 1.3 continues to suffer a lot of bugs, a lot of attacks return, including Blickenbacher on the RSA still present in TLS 1.2, and even padding oracle, and attacks like logjam that target weak Diffie-Hellman groups. And like we see a lot of attacks in TLS 1.2, but it keeps surviving because it's the current version we have. And it's also used today, and it's still secure because it's heavily patched, and it uses currently a heavily restricted set of cipher suites. But the real deal comes only at the end of this timeline, and this is TLS 1.3, which was standardized in 2018 and we keep using today. And the reason why I really like TLS 1.3 is that if I now add all the attacks to this slide, it becomes something like this. So we have a lot of red. Every balloon there is one attack on TLS, all the way up to TLS 1.2, and then they stop. So something must have changed with TLS 1.3. And since the history of TLS has been already told many times, I will explain how what we can learn from this broken crypto, but not using TLS as an example, using some more recent cryptographic breaks, and then showing what we can learn from the cryptographic breaks. I will start from Mega. You're maybe familiar with Mega as a file sharing application. It's, they also claim to be a secure cloud storage. And it's a secure cloud storage in the sense that it is end-to-end encrypted. So they claim that each user have their keys. Without a user key, nobody can read their files, not even Mega. Now, this work is when you want to create an account on Mega, your browser will generate a cryptographic RSA key, then will encrypt it with your passphrase, like the password that you use to log in into Mega, and only send this encrypted version of your key to the Mega server, which then can store it in a database. So like Mega never sees your actual RSA key. Then when you want to access your files or to upload a new file, you can log in into Mega with your password. You can ask for your keys. Mega will fetch them from the database, send them back to you. And now since you have your own password, you can decrypt this key and use it to encrypt your files with some RSA-based construction. Let's leave it at that. And this looks pretty good, doesn't it? I mean, it's at least at this level of abstraction, this could be secure. This is actually how we would build a secure cloud encrypted storage. But the problem with cryptography often lies in the details. And one thing that Mega committed is using AES ECB mode. It's not really visible now on the slide. This is the key derivation of Mega. So this is how your password is used to derive other keys and then to protect the RSA key that we were talking about before. So that component there, where the Luki is the key I was talking about before. And this is encrypted with AES-ECB. Is this a problem? Well, AES-ECB is not considered too secure, right? Like when, because of attacks like the ECB tax penguin, maybe some of you recognize that. If you encrypt two plaintext blocks with the same key, using AES-ECB, you will have the same ciphertext output. But this is not really a problem in this case, because we are encrypting high entropy material, such as a key. So there could be nothing wrong about this. In fact, like, let's take this example plaintext, hello CCC people, I encrypt it with ECB and I obtain some like garbage that nobody of you could decipher unless I give you the key to decrypt it and go back to hello CCC people. ECB also has an interesting property being applied to only one block. It's essentially like just applying the AES encryption operation on a single block. So if you change any single byte of the ciphertext, the result will be completely scrambled. Okay? So in AES-ECB, if I change one byte of the input block in this case, the entire output block will change. So this is still looking pretty good for us. It means that unless something very strange happens, Mega can still not see our keys, our secret protected RSA keys. But this is actually the root of one vulnerability that was found in Mega. So let's say that you register your RSA key with Mega, you store it, all fine. I'm just substituting the blue key with the actual piece of cryptography that is inside. And now you go to login. You ask for your keys, but instead of giving you your keys, Mega gives you something else, like some ciphertext that they have tampered with. Now, we know by ECB encryption that this will decrypt to garbage. And the problem now here is that the user cannot really tell this garbage from their RSA keys. So when the user receives this block of garbage, they will think, oh, this looks legit. Let's use it for some RSA operation. They will try to encrypt a file and then maybe fail or maybe succeed. But this operation, like this using garbage for RSA encryption, can and will leak something to the adversary about your key. So it's March 24, 2022, just last year. And one paper from our research group comes out, Mega Malleable Encryption Goes Awry. You will notice that academic cryptographers like dramatic titles. So, but the attack presented in this paper are actually very interesting. And in particular, we proved that with just 512 login attempts to Mega, Mega could recover your entire private key. This is very interesting. We went from a system that, from a high-level perspective, was completely secure to something that is trivially broken, or at least from our point of view, trivially broken in just 512 login attempts. Mega did fix this vulnerability, but they commented about the 512 number being an impractical number of login attempts for a standard Mega user. And that's where one of the principles that I want you to remember today kicks in. Because just a few weeks later, some of our colleagues from San Diego saw our paper and they thought, oh, well, we think we can do better. And so on July 13, we had the same attack, but in 6 queries. Now things start to get interesting because there is competition between 2 academic groups. And so we could not stop here. And there is this final comeback paper in September. After like a few months of very hard work, we managed to bring back the number of attempts needed to just 2 login attempts. So now, if Mega had not fixed their vulnerability, you could lose your RSA key in just 2 logins, which is pretty sweet. So first thing to remember from today is do fix it, even if it ain't broken yet, because attacks only get better. If you have an attack, it will not disappear. It cannot get worse over time. It can only get better. Maybe it will stay the same. Maybe it will keep being secure for a decade or so. But then you will get, eventually, a better attack. Staying on Mega, what we just saw, this capability of the server to change your key with something else, is called by a cryptographer a key overwriting attack, or for friends, KO. And I really want to show you another KO attack, this time against PGP, our beloved pretty good privacy. So the setting is as usual, except that the colors are not the gender norm ones. Alice and Bob both have PGP keys, want to exchange some secret message. So Alice writes her message, uses some PGP implementation, such as GNUPG, to encrypt it with Bob's key. And now we have a PGP encrypted message that can be sent out over the wire or over pigeons or whatever. Doesn't matter, because whoever intercepts this message will not be able to read it. Then Bob receives the message, uses the same or maybe another implementation to decrypt it, and can retrieve the plain text. All good so far. We have 2 users, 2 keys. And this would actually be pretty secure, pretty hard to break in this current restricted setting. One of the problems with PGP and MAME solution actually comes when you start putting things in practice and adding more depth. So for instance, let's take our user Bob. maybe Bob has one phone, then another old phone, maybe that uses only as a burner for conferences, then a laptop, and then an office computer. And still only one PGP key that now has to be shuffled somehow between all of these devices. So what do we do with this key? Well, one solution is we just put it everywhere on all of our devices. Another solution is we trust some other platform like Keybase or ProtonMail to keep the key for us in the cloud. And then we can access this cloud from all our devices. In either case, what happens if either the cloud or one of your devices gets hacked? So let's assume now that the adversary has access to your key for some limited amount of time. And here, PGP keeps us safe. So the structure of a key is actually like this. If you follow the standard, you have like most of the public parameters of your key are just plain text. But the really important bit, the private part of your key, is encrypted with your passphrase. So even if you left your key on your laptop and your laptop was unencrypted, your key was still locked, hopefully, if you set a password. And the same with Proton, like if you had your Proton account and your key was on Proton servers, then it would still need to get decrypted before you can use it. And well, this also looks like it's all fine. Like the important part of the key is actually encrypted and authenticated, so it cannot be modified by an adversary nor read by an adversary. So everything is OK, right? And as you can probably guess, well, it's not OK. Because the public part of the key is in a space of unprotected, unencrypted plain text, which means that not only the adversary can read it, this is OK in our public key setting, but the adversary can also modify it. And this leads us to more key overwriting attacks. The adversary changes that public part of the key and make it a PGP key, quote unquote, which is maybe no longer a correct key for public key operation, but still looks like a correct key to an unaware client, unless they do some very expensive verification of the key. And now the adversary can, like, after they had access to Bob's key, Bob will start using this key for normal encryption and decryption operations. So maybe the adversary Mallory can send a message to Bob. Bob will attempt to use the key to decrypt this message and get an error, which then will be communicated to Mallory, or maybe get no error, which then will be communicated to Mallory, maybe by hitting simply replying to an email, if it was an email, or if it's some other interactive system in some automated fashion. And now Mallory can observe these errors, or the absence of these errors from Bob, and learn something about the key, about Bob's key. And like this paper, also from some members and ex-members of our group, Victory by KO, presents one such attack against PGP, where if you repeat this cycle of like overwriting the key once, you only need to do that once as a cloud storage or as a evil maid, and then send 338 messages and observe the error or lack thereof, then you can recover a full 2048-bit Elgamal key from PGP. That's like a pretty interesting vulnerability from an academic standpoint, but also like from a practical standpoint, because if you use PGP maybe for emails, this wouldn't happen. It would be hard to make it happen 338 times. But if you start using it for cloud storage or like Keybase, you use it everywhere all over your infrastructure, then interesting things can happen, such as like the right setting to make this attack practical. And this could only get better, as we saw before. So how do you prevent key overwriting attacks? the solution is to always use authenticated encryption with associated data. Nowadays, like it's 2023, there is no reason not to use AAAD. It's as fast as any other encryption mode of operation. And it protects your ciphertext from tampering, which means that an adversary cannot change them. And there is no possible setting where you would want somebody to change your ciphertext without being able to decrypt them. So I think it's a very reasonable thing to assume that you don't want your ciphertext to be modified on the flight. And it also allows you to store unencrypted data that is still authenticated, so non-tamperable by an adversary. And this is also what happens actually in the OpenPGP, in the PGP cryptography refresh. They start using AAAD not just for the private part of the key, but for the entire key, so that the integrity of the key as a whole is protected. This is a toy example on how to use AAAD. It's really simple. There is a high level, if you like Python, you can use cryptography.io. It's a high level Python cryptography library that will help you not shoot yourself in your feet when writing crypto. And this is how you would use AAAD to encrypt a secret message with an authenticated but unencrypted AAAD. So, regarding to key overwrite attacks, do fix them, and in general, use at least authenticated encryption for everything. Now, I leave the floor to Ken.
That's okay. All right. So, because I'm a fan of spaced repetition, let me repeat the last two lessons that we've seen. So the first one being attacks only get better, and the second one, always use the authenticated encryption. So be careful about integrity. What I'm going to show you is now a set of other lessons that we want to present, and they sort of come from the following two papers. The first one, practically exploitable cryptographic vulnerabilities in Matrix. And of course, I'm sure all of you know Matrix because it's also the communication media that we're using for this camp. And the other paper being three lessons from Threema, analysis of a secure messenger, and this also comes from our group. Now, one thing that is in common between these two attack papers is the fact that they sort of are a complicated system which comprises of the interaction of multiple protocols, and in particular you have to be very careful when you're using some cryptographic material across different protocols. In particular, if you have different protocols which use the same cryptographic material, what I'm saying is that, for example, you have the same signing keys, you have the same encryption keys that you use across protocols, right? Then you could incur into some pitfalls. And in particular, if you are using the same key in the same way, then that means that you could take a message from one protocol and then use it in another protocol. Sure, then what does this mean? Let me make you an example. So we have on the left the so-called pizza protocol, and Alice is talking to the chef, and the chef has a key. And the chef asks, would you like some extra mozzarella? And of course, Alice would say, yes, of course, and then signs that message and encrypts it to the chef, right? And now Alice has used her cryptographic key to sign this message. And assume now that there is another protocol. You have the bank protocol, which confirms, which asks Alice to confirm whether she wants to transfer money, and Alice would use the same signing key for that protocol as well. And now you can imagine some scenario in which this chef is somewhat adversarial, and the bank then tries to go to the bank and says, "Hey, I'm Alice. Can you send $10 million to Alice?" And when communicating to Alice, then says that his key, like the keys of the attacker, is not his actual key, but is actually the key of the bank. And now, when Alice replies to this message, she will encrypt it with the key that was meant for the bank, saying yes, of course, and then signs the message very happily, saying this is coming from Alice. Any attacker can now just take the message from the protocol, from the pizza protocol, and then use it in the bank protocol. And now Alice has somewhat confirmed that she wants to send $10 million to Eve, to the attacker, rather by using the message from the other protocol. So this is an example of a cross-protocol attack. And as Egon from Ghostbusters always says, then don't cross the protocols, if I remember correctly, something like that. I'm going to show you now a couple of mitigations that you can use to protect yourself against this sort of cross-protocol interactions. And they all fall within the umbrella term of domain separation. So the first type of domain separation that I can show you, this is not all the types of domain separation that you can do, but I'm going to make a few examples. The first one is using key separation. So you've seen that that Mega, for example, has a interesting hierarchy of keys, and it's actually kind of necessary because you want to use each key for a different protocol. That ensures that whenever you are creating a message for protocol one, then it cannot be decrypted in protocol two. So instead of using the same key, K, for two different protocols, right, that would be key reuse, you use a key derivation function. For example, HKDF, the HMAC-based key derivation function, and then you derive different keys for each protocol. And here, again, is from cryptography.io, a couple of lines where it shows you have the starting key, which is my super secret master key, and then you derive two keys, K1 and K2. The difference here being in the info argument, where you can add some label, saying key proto 1 and key proto 2. And this will ensure that the resulting two keys, K1 and K2, are sort of independent from each other. That means that, for example, even if K1 is compromised, then K2 will remain secure. Okay, so this basically means, in the example that we seen just earlier, that assume the attacker can sort of steal a message from protocol 1, then it cannot send it into protocol 2, because in the protocol 2, the bank will not accept that message. It will not be able to decrypt it. It will be just garbage. Here's another type of mitigation that you can use. It's called message separation, and this could be useful, for example, when you want to use the same signature key, and this is actually more similar to the attack that we were showing just earlier. So assume that you can use the same keys for signing messages from different protocols. What you can do is you can separate the messages for each protocol. That is, for example, here we have a message, CCC is awesome. And whenever you sign it, you sort of prepend a message, a prefix that says this message is meant for protocol 1. This means that if somebody from protocol 2 tries to verify this message, then it will sort of see that this message does not start with protocol 1, and hence the verification with very high probability it will not verify. Right, so this is the lesson. Be careful about cross-protocol interactions. This can break a lot of things. And again, this is shown in the two papers that I said earlier. And domain separation sort of fixes this. And to actually be more explicit, in the Matrix protocol, there was an interaction between the Olm and MegOlm protocol, which could basically break confidentiality of messages in Matrix. And in Threema, we also managed to take some end-to-end messages, so some messages that you could send to a friend, and sort of take it from that protocol and use it to authenticate as the user. So sort of an impersonation attack. Now, I'm going to present for the next lesson a few couple interesting facts about some frequently used cryptographic primitives. Some of them you might have heard of. So one of them is curve 25519, which is a special type of elliptic curve. And it was created by Daniel Bernstein. It's actually very used because it's actually pretty fast, has very compact keys, and it seems perfect. However, it has an interesting property that I'm going to show you right now. So let's say, for example, that you have a protocol and you want to deny somebody that has a specific public key access to your protocol, right? You want to block it for some reason. And one idea that you could do is you do something like this. So you take the public key that is being used and say, oh, is this equal to the key that I want to block? And in that case, then you will just reject it. Otherwise, you do the important stuff, actually, and you start using that key. This seems sort of reasonable. This is the immediate way in which you would probably do it. And the question is, does it work? And the answer is actually it doesn't. And why does it not? Well, it doesn't because Curve2519 public keys have multiple equivalent representation for the same public key. And so what it means is that whenever you are trying to block a public key, you would sort of have to block all of the possible representations, or in a more solid way, you would try to sort of coerce the public key into a canonical form, in a sense, and then try to block that one, for example. And this is relevant, again, from the Threema paper, because in one instance, we have to claim to the server that our key is a special key. And then an immediate mitigation could be, oh, let's just block that special key. And actually, it doesn't work, because we have multiple representations. And here's a nice website where it explains the mathematics around the fact that this Curve2519 has 8 equivalent representations for the points. And I want to point out in particular that this is not true for every elliptic curve. Only like Curve2519 has a so-called cofactor of 8, and some other curves have prime order, which means that they don't have this property. So this is a specific thing for Curve2519. The next thing that I want to show you is, assume that you are using an AAD, which is good, because as it was one of the previous lessons. Well, it's not that simple either, because there are some pitfalls that happen with some commonly used AADs, for example, CHA-20, Poly-1305, AES-GCM. Well, many people would think that if you have a ciphertext, then it can only be correctly decrypted with the correct key. And the real thing that we should say is that if you have a message, you encrypt it with one key. You can only get the original message if you have the correct key. However, decrypting correctly is sort of a nuanced kind of term. And what we usually mean is that whenever you have an AAD, the integrity part says everything is correct. You can go on with the protocol. However, it is not true that only the original key will make this ciphertext decrypt correctly, and it can be true that the same ciphertext decrypts correctly under multiple keys. And in some cases, it might give you garbage, but in particular, we can also show that one could forge a specific ciphertext that can decrypt to meaningful different messages if used with different keys. Pictorially, actually, this comes from this very nice paper, which is called Fast Message Franking, From Invisible Salamanders to Encryptment. Read the paper to understand what this means. So let's say you take a message that has been encrypted, and you use the first key and you get one kind of message, and then you use a different key, then you get a completely different but still meaningful message, and you can do so with multiple of them. And this is actually pretty interesting, because let's say that you have, this actually comes up in some group messaging applications, where let's say that you send an encrypted version of, let's say, an image to an entire group, and then you send the keys to the specific people. Then you could think of a scenario in which you are sending different keys to different people. And let's say that I want to pull a prank on one of my friends, then I would send the keys that decrypt to a completely safe image to most of my friends, and then to a specific friend that I want to prank, I would send him a specific key that would, I don't know, send some random, maybe disturbing image, let's say. You know, and then you could sort of use it for some evil purposes, let's say. So in general, what I want to say about these two previous case studies is that the primitives are actually quite subtle, right? And you sort of have to know them. You sort of have to know the tools that you are actually using, because they have different properties, and some of them can be can be actually dangerous for your protocol. So do get to know what your primitives provide, but especially what they don't provide. For example, in the previous one, you are not guaranteed that you will only that a ciphertext will decrypt correctly only with the original key. Now, the next lesson I want to talk about is about Bridgify, and Bridgify is a peer-to-peer messaging application. I'm not going to go into the details, but the important point that I want to say, first of all, again, this comes from members of our group, is that maybe one could think, right, so I'm not very good at developing cryptography, so I'm just going to take a cryptographic library, maybe a cryptographic protocol entirely, and I'm going to slap it on top of my protocol so that it's secure. Well, the Bridgeify case study tells us that in reality this is not true. And in fact, Bridgeify had, there was a previous paper that attacked Bridgeify, and now there is a, this following paper says that you can still compromise the confidentiality of private messages by using a race condition, and basically you sidestep the guarantees of the library. So what this shows you is that even if you try to, you know, you try to fix everything with LibSignal, it is not really that simple. You really have to be careful even when you use safe cryptographic libraries and safe cryptographic protocols that you try to integrate within your product. And so the lesson is, safe libraries won't save you from yourself.
Now for the final part of this talk, let's go back to TLS. So this is what we saw before, a red wave of attacks that then stops at the walls of TLS 1.3. How is that so? So TLS 1.3 is special, and one of the things that makes it special is formal verification, provable security. When TLS 1.3 was published, there were some formal proofs of its correctness and of its security, and this like provable security approach will catch most, if not all, of the gotchas that we presented before. So like if you have lack of key committing or lack of authenticated encryption or key reuse because key are not separated, then provable security will catch this for you. And we are slowly moving in this direction of having all of our important protocols proven secure formally. So Signal has multiple analyses of security. So does WireGuard, Matrix, and as of a few weeks ago, Trimas IBEX forward security protocol. What else makes TLS 1.3 different? I think it would be unfair to say that it's just a matter of proving it's secure. Provable security alone is not enough. TLS actually had a proactive standardization process where multiple drafts were presented to a working group before TLS was even made public, and cryptographer had time to work through these drafts and find attacks well above time. It is also accompanied with a lot of formally verifiable implementation. And being such a big and important protocol, it took years of research time to analyze it, to make a formal specification, to find all the attacks well before it was published in 2018. All of this is a luxury that most of us, like common protocol developers, cannot afford. We don't have enough money or enough time to do all of this every time we want to write a cryptographic protocol, but we can start with less. For instance, just with formally verifying our cryptography, trying to come up with a proof or commissioning a proof. And also by being careful not to fall in the common gotchas, some of which we presented here. So keep up to date with the last cryptographic trends if you're doing crypto. We add like this mantra in cryptography, don't roll your own crypto. This was referring mainly to don't roll your own cryptographic primitives, because when people were trying to make their own block ciphers, there were a lot of problems. And we actually nowadays see the benefits of this. People mostly have stopped rolling their crypto. Nobody uses their own block cipher. Everybody uses AES or standardized elliptic curves, standardized AAD. Should this become don't roll your own protocol? Because as we just seen, even if you have secure primitives and you combine them together in the wrong way, the overall construction may not be secure at all. And the answer is yes and no. Like, if we don't roll our own protocols. If you don't roll your own protocols, then who should? Only a bunch of academics or big committees that have time and resources sufficient to spend like years analyzing the protocols before are published? And I really do want to leave you with this question and hear, of course, about all of your questions, but also about your opinions on who and how cryptography should be developed. So thank you for listening. I will leave you with a meme and wait for your questions.
Thank you very much. We do have about 4 minutes left for questions until we need to close down the talk. So if you have any questions, please line up in the middle by this near this nice angel, and we have the first question. So go on.
Test, test, test. Yeah. Going back to the key overwriting attack, I was wondering if you can only have one bit of information, either that decrypts to a correct key or doesn't, how can you get more out of it? Obviously, I'm missing something. Mm-hmm.
So it depends a lot on which key, which protocol you're attacking. So you could only get one key. Like usually, the output is either an error message or decryption successful. So like this is by itself one bit of information, zero and one. How you get more? It could be that like each bit of information that you get is a sieve. So like you're actually doing like split and search. So you can do this in logarithmic time, or it could be that you only need to recover part of the key, and then for the rest you run like exhaustive attack or some lattice attack.
Okay, I think we have time for one more.
Hello. So I have a question about the mega attack on their encryption. So the password, the key is derived from the password, but how does the login process work? Because if I remember correctly, with most password hashing solutions that store the key server side, you need to send the plaintext login password over there, so they could theoretically use that to derive it themselves.
So if I remember correctly, I don't know for sure, but the most reasonable way to do this would be take your passphrase, use it to derive one cryptographic key, and then derive two keys from this main key. One you send to the server, and the other you use for encryption. So even if the server knows this key, it cannot walk back through. Like the KDFs are not invertible, so they still cannot know your main hash.
Okay, thank you very much. And if there are any more questions, I'm sure Kian Matteo will be available afterwards. So please give a warm round of applause for this great talk.